Okay, we talked about, by way of review, we talked about the Reformed Presbyterian churches last lesson or so. When you talk about Presbyterians, basically what theology do they follow? Calvin. One exception to that being Cumberland. And there's actually, I didn't think there was, but I looked it up. There's actually a couple of Cumberland Presbyterian churches in the Houston area. So I don't know if you ever run into anybody, but if you do, they do not follow that, of course.
They put it on their sign out front?
I don't know.
You know. Some say, like Baptists, some say FCC,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I don't know. Don't know. There's a section on the questions called assignment, just to talk about the things that were in the, at least in your lesson. I know you don't have the Westminster Confession in total, the things we took out of that. How would you respond to the teaching on predestination? You're trying to show somebody that that's not what the Bible taught.
Well, predestination is true, but it was the plan and the people who would be obedient to that plan, per se, that was predestined.
To perish. And so if he's already predestined for some to perish, that just makes, you know, this a lie.
Okay, you can go to Acts 10:30, same kind of thing. Acts 10:34, God doesn't show partiality. So there's, you know, what's the basic Bible study rule we talk about all the time?
CNH.
And you start looking at the harmony of that doctrine with the Bible, it doesn't, very simply. What about limited atonement? I don't know how they prove it otherwise.
Yeah.
We talk about Wesley, and that's in fact how he concluded it. What about limited atonement?
It's kind of like what she was saying there at 2 Peter 3 and the verses you used out of Acts 10. They all lead to that same thing because these are kind of a domino. Once you start defeating them, some of these verses have more applications to their steps. It's not limited. It's to open to anyone. For God so loved, John 3:16.
Okay.
That's a good verse. 1 John 2:2,
he's propitiation for the sin of the world. Died for all men, not for a few, in Hebrews 2. Salvation is available to all, Titus 2. So, you know, it's easy to show how that doctrine does not fit with the Bible.
What's
teaches.
Difficult is to understand how it can't be understood by some.
Well, it is and it isn't. You know, it goes back to, may not be a good analogy, but it goes back to when you think about, or you make another comparison when you think about what Christ did when he was here. He taught the apostles for 3 years, and yet even up to the point in time that he was taken to be crucified, and after, they still didn't understand. And so, he got to the point where if you put yourself in the position of the fossils, we run the risk of saying, how in the world could that ever be? And yet, I don't want to be so bold to say we couldn't be just as blind as they were. And clearly people are blind. And the thing about, I don't know if you pick up on it, it's kind of hard to avoid it. One of the things about the play out of the various denominations starting if you go back to the time of the Catholic Church, one of the things that happens is that people get ingrained in something and they follow that teaching, whatever it is, and the church becomes the guide. And that happened with the Catholic Church. And as you see the Reformation come in, and you have, well, let's start with the Church of England. You know, the Church of England basically carried on a lot of the same things the Catholic Church carried on, except now the king was going to run the church, not the Pope. And then when the Reformation comes along, you see what lineage follows the Reformation. People stick, even though they modify these various confessions, they modify them just marginally. They fundamentally stick with the same basic theology. And it goes, a lot of that goes back to this is what I am, what I was born into, what my parents were. And I don't know if people even give thought to it anymore. And they just follow on in the path of whatever they're in. Some of that goes on. It's got to be.
Well, Jesus says in John 17, sanctify them through thy word. Thy word is truth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what's lost today is the truth of God's word and the importance of truth. Because there's no search for truth anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to what we've talked about over and over again, is words of authority. And authority is not people looking to the Bible for their authority anymore. I say that as a general statement. There are no doubt people, even within those groups, who get exposed to those who know the truth and will sit down with the Bible and study with them and will convert them. They'll come to see. There's no question in my mind, a man searching for truth, he's got a good heart and he's searching for truth, truth will find him. And and God's not going to let us down on that. And we got people in here that came out of some of the very things we're talking about because they were exposed to truth by some means in their past.
That's the key, though. You have to be challenged. You have to be exposed to truth, because otherwise you think once saved, always saved. Why should I be studying?
You can. You were Baptist way back when, Catholic, Methodist. I don't know what other people came out of other denominations or not in here, but people are not locked into these things. It's a question of whether or not they have the desire or have some circumstances that come upon them where they're exposed and challenged, as Jim says. And can be reached.
I just want to make a comment. One of the fundamental principles on the spy agencies that they rely on, the ones successful, is that people are creatures of habit. That's a fundamental principle they use, and that's how they.
What's
how the spy?
What are you saying?
The spy agency, CIA, and other ones, they're based on the principle that people are creatures of habit. So, anyway. My point is for us, we look at all this doctrine, and we look at the Bible, and we say, okay, well, Christ is to be our first priority, cost of discipleship. We might be in a rut ourselves, in this thing. Maybe didn't make first priority. We were talking about all this stuff. So well, we can look at our own individuals and apply these things, and we might be blind ourselves, and here we're sitting in this classroom.
Yeah, good point. I think it goes back, and we've said this several times in here. We can be fooled, and we can get lazy. I mean, there's just a lot of things we can do, individually we can do, and find ourselves off on the wrong track. And it's no different. There would be no different standing before God than anybody else in that circumstance. So it's easy enough. We always need to be exposing our thinking. I mean, I'm not talking about taking out and exposing it so much as thinking in terms of what conclusions are we reached about certain issues and why do we reach those. And that's why study just becomes all that more important for each and every one of us. Okay, perseverance of the saints. Acts 8. Good one. This reminds me of the... I'm not going to go through this joke. It reminds me of the joke in the prison. If you're one, it's hilarious. Yeah. Hebrews 6 is a good one. 2 Peter 2 is another good one that you can use to challenge people that hold to these doctrines. And I think you'll find they're going to have a hard time answering it. That doesn't say they're going to change their views, they're just going to have a hard time answering them. Okay, let's get into 18. the Methodist Church. Methodist Church is another movement. We talked about back lesson 12 or 13, whichever it was, about the Presbyterians and the independent and separatist Congregationalists and the English Baptists that would ultimately come out of the Church of England. And the Methodists is another group that traces its roots back to the English Church. As I say in your notes there, it's 100 years later than these other things we've studied. It has a little bit of the same flavor in terms of the people that were there wanting to reform, in effect, the Church of England. And that was not to happen 100 years later, as we'll talk about. The thing about the Church of England at this time, as mentioned about the Catholic, is Catholic heritage. Remember that they kept a lot of the same activities that the Catholic Church had. I'll throw a word out to you, sacerdotalism. Anybody know what sacerdotalism is?
Sounds serious.
Doesn't it, though? I have to look these words up. I mean, they're not things I've been. It's the idea of the priest that stands between man and God. And so that's a practice. And that's what the Church of England practiced, just like the Catholic Church. So you had that going on, and you had their very formalized religion. And that gave rise to what would become the Methodist denomination. The three characters that we're going to talk about, three main ones, are a fellow named George Whitefield, and of course John Wesley and his brother Charles. At the point in time these three guys come on the scene, they're already in reaction to this structured approach and sort of dead, dry approach that the Church of England is going through, would go through in their worship. You had these groups called societies that got formed. The idea was to put a little life and enthusiasm into the church and to try to cause it to have a revival of sorts in terms of morality more than anything. Not so much to change the liturgy and that sort of thing. Samuel Wesley, who's the father of John and Charles, was one of the people that started one of these so-called societies. The societies actually were just members of the Anglican Church members that would group together and have these various, depending on the society, have these various studies. John and his brother Charles would start one of these, and the story would go on from then. We got one reporter left. I'm going to let him talk about John Wesley, and then we'll see what we... Oh, no, not a book. You're not allowed to put a book out.
That's not too bad. Brian will read the whole thing.
Are you sure you didn't major in history?
Yeah.
He's always told
to flip. 2 minutes is all you got. I'm the guy that gets spent all the time. You get 2 minutes.
Let's see. John Wesley, June 28, 1703, March 2, 1791, Anglican minister and Christian theologian. He was an early leader in the Methodist movement. Methodism had three rises, first at Oxford with the founding of the Holy Club, the second while he was parish priest in Georgia, the third in London after he returned. Movement took form from its third rise in the early 1740s with Wesley along with others entering field preaching and subsequent founding of religious societies for the formation of believers. This was the first widely successful evangelical movement in the UK. Wesley's Methodist connection included societies throughout England, Scotland, Wales, and Ireland before spreading to other parts of the English-speaking world and beyond. He divided his religious societies further into classes and bands for intensive accountability and religious instruction. Methodist under Wesley's direction became leaders in many social justice issues of the day, including prison reform and abolitionism movements. Wesley's strength as a theologian lay in his ability to combine seemingly opposing theological stances. His greatest theological achievement was his promotion of what he termed Christian perfection or holiness of heart and life. Wesley insisted that in life, the Christian should come to his faith for the love of God or perfect love reigns supreme in one's heart. In evangelical theology especially, his understanding of Christian perfection was firmly grounded in his sacramental theology. He continually insisted on the general use of the means of grace, prayer, scripture, meditation, holy communion, etc., as a means by which God transforms the believer. Throughout his life, Wesley remained within the Church of England and insisted that his movement was well within the bounds of the Church. His maverick use of church policy put him at odds with many in the Church of England, though toward the end of his life, he was widely respected. A couple other notes in the packet, which I found interesting. He was the 15th of 19 children, and his mother was one of 24. Just a little real quick code. In his early years, John Wesley had enjoyed a deep religious experience. His brother, Hyerman, says that he had kind of a rough youth. He went to the Charterhouse Inn, a saint, but he became negligent of his religious duties and left a sinner. Another thing, and we'll leave it at this, is kind of interesting. When he went to Georgia, it didn't really work out. He was very depressed. Father just died. I'll just read you this. John's time in Georgia was unfortunate and short-lived. He had an unhappy love affair, which culminated in John's refusal to serve communion to his prospective wife and her husband. Husband John charged John with slander, disgraced his wife, and basically headed back to England.
Okay.
Pretty interesting reading. Very, very hard worker, it seems.
You probably got some. I'll give you some facts and figures in a minute. If we get to it. Very interesting guy. I guess if you're one of 19 kids, you learn to accomplish certain things just to survive. John, as was stated on that first page you looked at, he was involved in this activity, so-called societies. He and his brother got one started in Oxford, and these things were called holy clubs. They were called several things, actually. They were called holy clubs. They were called, Bible bigots, called Bible moths, because they fit on the Bible as moths on cloth. They were referred to also as sacramentarians, and lastly they were called Methodists. And they would get together, and their reason for getting together, very, very enthusiastic type, some would call fanatical, and they got together to study the Bible. That's what they were doing. And when they got the moniker put on them of Methodists, that started out because evidently at Oxford they got named that because of the method of the teaching program at Oxford. But with time they sort of modified that and said it's Methodist means the method of living according to the Bible. So it got like words in the English language. It took on a new meaning that fit what they wanted it to call it. And so they got their start there. This fellow Whitefield went to Oxford, was befriended by both the Wesley brothers, and ended up involving himself in the Holy Club. John, and this is in around 17, well, it's several years after being in school, ended up preaching a sermon that was entitled The Circumcision of the Heart, and evidently made an impression on the people there in the university. He actually started to be recognized at that point as a theologian. He'd be in his 30s, well, it was actually in 1703, so he's 30 years old at that stage. And in it were these were two doctrines that were sort of basic to his position at that time. One, Christian perfection, which was hit upon a moment ago, and the other is the witness of the Spirit, that we're children of God. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. Let me just spend a little bit of time on Whitefield. Whitefield, as I mentioned, he became part of this holy club, and he had a conversion while he was at Oxford, and he ended up being convinced that spiritual regeneration, some type of spiritual regeneration, was necessary for salvation. And he actually was a deacon in the Anglican Church shortly thereafter, but he started preaching. And the doors were getting closed to his preaching in the Anglican churches because of what he was preaching. But he would preach whenever he had the opportunity, anywhere he had the opportunity. And it ended up that he did something that was just unheard of in that time, day and time, and that is, apart from speaking in rented buildings and that kind of thing, he went out into the open fields and started preaching. And people just didn't do that. It was scandalous, in fact, at the time. And so he was a fairly dynamic, active preacher. And at this point in time, part of what would be considered the Methodist crowd, he preached, if my math's right, he preached about, on average, about 10 sermons a week. And this went on for 30-plus years of his ministry. So you can imagine this guy was quite busy in preaching wherever he could and whenever he could. Ended up making 7 or 8 trips over to the U.S. to the colonies at the time, and went up to Scotland. Did a lot of traveling. And what happened with him, however, there's actually a group that's a product of this. He took. The position of Calvin for his theology. He was Calvinistic. And as a result of that, he separated himself from the Wesley brothers because they were Armenian. Remember, Armenian theology is basically free will theology. And Whitefield was very much Calvinistic and would preach on the bound will, but he was a very dynamic preacher in terms of getting people to change their lives. And he preached, in fact, he's the guy, we've talked about the Great Awakening in here, in that started over in the colonies. He's the fellow that's recognized as the person responsible for starting that. On one of these trips, several of these trips, he'd come over and he would preach. One of the trips, he came here, he made 45 days, he preached 175 sermons. So he was preaching 4 sermons a day during that 45 days. So he's a busy guy. Very aggressive. He just, anytime he had the opportunity to preach, that's fundamentally what he was about. One of the things that's interesting about this fellow, this is trivia. He could be heard, it is said, by 30 up to 30,000 people. They could hear him clearly. It's how powerful a voice he was. And others have claimed that he could be heard a mile away. And, you know, this isn't using PA systems. This is just his natural voice. And I find that phenomenal, that these guys had that kind of delivery. But he did, apparently. He also believed personal study was important. And as a result of that, he got directly involved in starting Princeton here, the College of Philadelphia, which is the University of Pennsylvania today, and Dartmouth College. So this guy was behind the formation of all three of those and was working on a fourth one when he died. So I want to give you a little bit of background on Whitefield and who he was. He interacts with Wesley brothers both in England and in the colonies over the course of his lifetime. Even though they separated in terms of their theology, there actually is a Calvinistic Methodist church that exists. As far as I can tell, it's in England. I couldn't find any evidence of it being over here, having been transported over here. But you know, Methodists, that's not their, they're Armenian in their beliefs, and the Methodist Church we're familiar with here follows that kind of theology. Clint mentioned the Georgia trip. Wesley went over to Georgia. This was in 1735 or so. Came over with General Oglethorpe, if you've ever heard that name from your history. It was on the boat where was a group of Moravians that we talked about briefly back many lessons ago. And when he got here and spent his time here, he wasn't here but 2 years in Georgia, and is about it, because of the indiscretion, I guess I would call it, plus the fact they were very strict. He had a hard time, they had a hard time making much headway on that trip, bringing about any disciples and creating any churches out of their effort. So he really, as a, in terms of the trip, he failed. One of the things on coming over, though, and changed his life, they were in a, on the trip with the Moravians, they had a were in a storm. And the story goes, he was scared to death. You know, he just kind of cowered down in the corner someplace and hunkered down waiting for the storm to go over, shaking in his boots. Moravians were at peace. And that impressed him. And so he headed back over to England after his time in Georgia, and reflected on his life as he was going by. And there's a quote, just to give you a sense of it. "I went to America to convert the Indians, but oh, who shall convert me? What is he that shall deliver me from the evil heart of unbelief? I have a fair summer religion. I can talk well, nay, and believe myself while no danger is near. But let death look me in the face, and my spirit is troubled. Nor can I say to die is gain. I show my faith by my works, by staking my all upon it. Oh, who will deliver me from the spear of death?" So he was impacted. And here it is 2 years later, after he's failed in Georgia and he's heading back to England, he still has that sense of failure. When he got back, he ended up going and associating himself with the Moravians. There was a fellow by the name of Bowler that was part of that. And based on his Bowler's preaching, Wesley became convinced, John did, well, both of them really, that each believer ought to be able to point to a specific point in time when they're converted. And, of course, you and I can do that today because we obeyed the gospel. Well, if you've got a good enough memory, you can. When you obeyed the gospel, you can point to the day that salvation came your way. Well, they felt that there needed to be some way of doing that, some place, some circumstance, when, where, and by what means the assurance of an individual pardon came about. And so that was a belief he started to take on, and he kept moving on from there, waiting for that time to come where he'd have that kind of an assurance. And he'd eventually, to his satisfaction, get that. And I think I mentioned that in your notes. He was when was it? 1738. His heart was strongly warmed. I mean, strangely warmed, and God gave him assurance of salvation. So this was true heartfelt religion. And John Wesley's conversion took place in that fashion.
I think it's sort of funny, though, that he's reading a commentary that was written by Luther. I mean, a commentary on Luther's notes on Romans, and instead of the Bible, you know, and the Holy Spirit directly, you know, operating on his heart type of thing. He's reading Luther.
Yeah, I guess, you know, Luther camped in Romans like Calvin did, and as a result, you know, a lot of that theology, although Wesley wasn't going to have the theology of Calvin, he would have the theology or the belief that there's a the impact of grace, salvation without works, salvation by faith alone would be important. And so he would get that as well. But this other, I mean, you're right in terms of, you know, where he got his source of inspiration. But remember, he's had this background teaching out of the Moravians. He's prepared. He's looking. He's searching for this heart conversion. And he'll get it. Believed he had it that day. And so this was in, was it Aldersgate? Yeah, Aldersgate Street when this happened. So this is a famous, you know, this is a big thing, I guess, to, at least to the theologians of the Methodist Church today. I don't know if it's such a big thing to those who are members that worry about it. It wasn't long after that he preached a sermon, "By Grace You're Saved Through Faith," and that's his fundamental belief. I mean, that's belief I have, but his belief in that is, his take on that is certainly different than what the Bible's take is. Okay, so that's how he ended up being converted, and he'd go on to form the rest of his theology as time went on. After that point in time, he took off to Germany immediately after that, met with a fellow that was a leader of the Moravians in Germany, and then went back to England and started preaching wherever he could, whenever he could. And he, like Whitefield, saw the doors of the Anglican Church close on him. And so he ended up, because of that, while he was closed out of that, he was invited to these societies. And the societies were still operating within the Anglican Church. So there was a place for him to preach. He just couldn't preach in an official fashion as part of the Church of England. He was encouraged by this great awakening that was going on with Whitefield. So, and Whitefield by this point in time, or I say by this point in time, back, and Whitefield kept going back and forth. And some of the time Whitefield was here, he ended up preaching in England. Not here, but back in England, he ended up preaching in England, in the Bristol area, and that's where Wesley ended up going to, John did. And so that sort of was the starting point of the Methodist revival in England. And it was around 1739. And his comment was he looked at the whole world as his parish, because he basically was out of the Church of England. He wasn't out physically, literally. He was out in terms of being able to do official duties for the Church of England. He would remain a member, as was said a moment ago, of the Church of England. Never got out of it. He would schedule his meetings where they wouldn't conflict with the Church of England services. He did. You just think about this for a minute. The guy traveled, now this is on horseback, in his lifetime, 50 years of preaching. He traveled 250,000 miles, a lot of that in England and on up to Scotland. In the course of that time, he preached 42,000 sermons, which is two a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. He was preaching. And, of course, he had time. He took time off while he was riding. He wasn't preaching and things like that. There were times when he would be preaching four and five times a day. And in the meantime, since he would be bored the rest of the time, he wrote over 200 books. So he was writing. He was turning out a book about once every 3 months while all this was going on. Yeah, Mike?
You know, his busyness, you know, is impressive. And I'll say this, if we look at some of the preaching efforts done by, say, the brother we support in Italy, you know, you read how he's traveling, he's preaching several times on Sunday and through the week in various classes, not to try to count it and see what it is.
Right.
But there's some of the men that we support that are quite busy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, busy is not a check mark for being right. It just shows you how. Just the point is, the fellow is very committed and very productive in the environment he found himself in. And I think you look at what he turned out in that period of time. It's just a tremendous amount of output. And this was also at the same time that he was organizing what would be the Methodist, become the Methodist Church. So, as an individual, pretty impressive to me, but a very committed guy. Just gives you a sense of how committed he was personally in what he was doing. And he was, 85 years of age, and he was still preaching 2 or 3 times a day. So, from the standpoint of strictly the zeal, you can't fault the man for the zeal that he had. He would stay with the Anglican Church, and that would he'd be there the day he died. And in fact, the Methodist Church really never separated itself officially. Some declaration like the Anglican Church separated itself from the Catholic Church. It just worked out that way. And the way it worked out was because of the ordination. They were not allowed to practice the sacraments. They could not have their people, that is the Methodists, lay people, be ordained by the Church of England. And so over time, they eventually got to the point where they ordained Wesley, ordained them to preach in England and to carry out their sacraments. And so that's how the church sort of just developed out of the Anglican Church and just became a denomination within England. Okay, so that really is the lion's share of the activities that were going on with him in terms of England. And at the same time, of course, you had Whitefield going back and forth, and you would have Wesley, John, ended up coming back to the States and preaching as well during the last half of the 1700s, and would spend time here with that group. He also had involvement with a couple of fellows, one Philip Embury and the other one Strawbridge. And they, went back up from there. What's the Church of England in the colonies was called what? Remember? Somebody said it. Episcopal. So they, just like there were societies being set up in England, in the Church of England, there were societies were forming inside of the Episcopal Church in the colonies. And so that's where these fellows would come over and they'd start these societies. And would work with the groups and work with the society. And Wesley worked hard to keep those societies from actually splitting out from the Episcopal Church at the time, at least while he was alive in the early part of this development. It ended up because of the growth. He ended up sending a fellow by the name of Francis Asbury to go over and help out, and ended up that Asbury became a pretty dominant figure in what would develop as the Methodist, it would be called the Methodist Episcopal Church, be the name of the church that would form. So as mentioned, they had to depend upon, at this time they were depending upon the Episcopal clergy, just like they were depending upon the Church of England clergy in England and the States. Colonies, they were depending upon the Episcopal priest to carry out the various sacraments, the Lord's Supper, baptism, marriage in their case, and to bury the dead. And the Methodist congregations, these groups, wanted to have ordained clergy. And nobody could do that. Except the London, the bishop in London, and he wasn't about to do it. And so finally, Wesley ordained this fellow named Thomas Coke and gave him authority to ordain other ministers. And so Coke comes over, he ordains this fellow Asbury, and they ended up serving as superintendents of the societies, and then eventually in 1784, what was called the Christmas Conference, they managed to say, no longer will we be part of the Anglican Church, or the Episcopal Church, excuse me, but they would become part of the Methodist Episcopal Church. So they actually, in the States, unlike in the England has just sort of drifted there. In the States, they made an overt statement that they were separating themselves out from the Episcopal Church. And so that day sort of marks the day they made that decision. That's the history in a few brief moments. Any questions about that before we get on to theology? Named after this guy, no doubt. Yeah, Rocky.
I didn't understand how Whitefield is involved with this Methodist, since his beliefs are so different. Why is he so prominent in this?
They maintained their friendship, even though they had a difference in opinion, in terms of God's mode of operating with men. They never really separated in terms of, I guess, the example of the Catholic Church and the Church of England. That kind of separation never came about. They separated. They went their own ways gradually. The people that they taught and would develop, at least in the English side, into this Calvinistic Methodist, would follow that teaching. But they continued to work together and to preach together in the same areas. And it's not to say that they sit down and plan out meetings together. They just knew one another, respected one another, and were involved with one another. But yeah, they're two different theologies, clearly. Anything else? Has it been, how long ago were you in the Methodist Church? Can you remember?
38 years.
I won't call on you to remember all those. No doubt it's changed a lot. Wesley's theology, we'll spend a little bit of time on. I'd already mentioned this concept, and so did Clint, about perfectionism. There's a role grace plays, and I mentioned just to get into a little more detail, probably next class. But because of God's grace and the effect of God's grace, the proactivity of God's grace on a person. Wesley taught that it was possible for a Christian, to attain enough love for God and love of neighbor to be free from sin. And supposedly he really taught that more as a goal as opposed to believing there was anybody that was like that. But that theology, that teaching, of course, this logical conclusion is, if that's what you believe and God's not going to fail, then logically it would drive you to say, yeah, there are people that ought to be able to live without sin. And there are those who took what he said all the way to that extreme. And I think it was a small group, but some of his followers followed that kind of a logical conclusion. The other thing that he had different from the Church of England, of course, was the whole issue of the fact that he was an Armenian in theology. And the Church of England had a hostility to Calvinism, to those not Calvinistic. Okay, we will pick up, Lord willing, with, where am I? Yeah, we'll get into the modern Methodist Church. I want to cover the beliefs around grace, because I think helps you understand where they come from on their theology. There's lesson 19 up here. You want to pick up one of those on your way out?